minerals your body needs. The Berkey Light is so powerful it can purify raw, untreated water from remote lake streams and stagnant ponds. The Berkey Light is transparent and glows in the dark with its rechargeable LED lighting system, so it can be used as a night light or camp light.
Get the Berkey Light Purifier for only $279. Call New Millennium, 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438. Or order on the web at berkeywater.com.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mike McNulty, who is instrumental in putting out a video called Waco, the Rules of Engagement, and a subsequent film, which I think is so much more important, called Waco, A New Revelation, because here you'll actually see the interviews with people who talk to the members of the Special Forces who were there. And, of course, all the indications are that the Davidians were executed. They were all constantly shot in the back of the head. Do you think that's what they did to themselves? And then what about the little women and children? Is that did they plan on killing them? Or were there, and what were the members of the Special Forces doing there? And you're never going to hear this any other place except on this DVD, which Mike was instrumental in bringing about. What really happened at Waco? Well, that's what the message that we need to get out right now, because Waco, and then, of course, we saw what happened in Oklahoma City. We saw what happened in New York City on September 11th, but it really all started with Waco. And they got away with what happened at Waco when, of course, they used the military in violation of the law against American civilians. So with that as the background, Mike McNulty, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, glad to be here, Dr. Stan. Thank you for having me.
Why don't you go ahead and pick up this story, because we should never forget about Waco.
Well, I think the one thing, that I would add is, many people, considering this was 15 years ago, would say, well, why is Waco important now? Well, for the same reason that the Revolutionary War and understanding how it came about and why is important to the concept of the preservation of freedom. Likewise, understanding how the incident at Waco and understanding it is essential for understanding the concept of the preservation of freedom. Because if we do not remember our history, as Dr. Santana said, we're doomed to repeat the same mistakes. So understanding it is important, and knowing what really happened is important. However, there are some other, perhaps less significant reasons why it might be important today. I noted in the news today that the young lady who was the campaign manager for Hillary Rodham Clinton was hired by the Obama campaign, and that she was hired to head the staff in the vice presidential search. And I'm not sure if Mr. Obama's trying to telegraph something to us, but I thought that was rather interesting.
In other words, they hired Hillary's former chief of staff to begin looking for a vice president. And you're suggesting that wouldn't it be interesting if he should pick Hillary Clinton? Because, of course, there were certain things in that DVD, Waco, A New Revelation, that deal specifically with Hillary Clinton. Isn't that true?
Yes, sir. We got real curious because of the lack of attention paid by the congressional investigation and the Senate investigation and the press's investigation in following, going around a roadblock that was established firmly by Janet Reno in saying that the buck stops here, I accept responsibility. Well, accepting it and having been responsible were two different things. And the image that was created, the false image, I might add, that Janet Reno somehow was responsible, actually couldn't be further from the truth.
In other words, of course, nothing could have happened without the full cooperation of the President Clinton and maybe his wife, who was almost a co-president. We'll be right back in just a moment with Mike McNulty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And our special guest this afternoon is Mike McNulty. And Mike is, of course, an investigative reporter, but rather than reporting for newspapers, he reported for a video. And he put out, certainly, a couple of very important videos. The first one he participated in called Waco, A New Revelation, which we still carry, about what happened back there in April of 1993. But then, of course, he put out a second DVD some years later called Waco, A New Revelation. What was the new revelation? Well, it was the fact that the government, in violation of our own laws and the laws of Posse Comitatus, and with a conscious cooperation of the media which concealed the truth from the American people, the government had actually used special forces there against the Davidians. And, of course, we know that they, all the Davidians ended up with a bullet in their back. And they had those who died inside. Did they shoot one another? Is that what happened to them? And then, of course, what about the women and children? And well, anyway, Mike's done a wonderful job on this DVD, and he was instrumental in getting it produced. We do have this available on DVD now. It's called Waco, A New Revelation. Because, of course, as George Santayana said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And unless we understand what happened back there in 1993, we will never understand what happened in Oklahoma City in 1995, what happened in New York City on September 11th, when 3,000 Americans died. So go ahead, pick up the story there, Mike.
Well, I think the most impressive thing about Waco was what wasn't told, what wasn't investigated, what questions weren't asked. I think that's a hallmark of the whole incident. The media failed to ask the magic question. Ms. Reno, we know you were the Attorney General, and we know that Mr. Clinton said that you do what you think is right, Janet, but we also know that Delta Force was present, the Combat Applications Group, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, at Waco, and in some numbers, and they could not be present without a presidential directive or an executive order being signed by William Jefferson Clinton. And the question is, what was going on in the White House that day, Ms. Reno? Obviously, she doesn't know, so where do you go to find out? Well, we started poking around a little bit, and the first thing we came across was some very, very unhappy Texas Rangers, two captains of Texas Rangers. And yes, the Texas Rangers are every bit of the legend that surrounds them. TV show with our friend, the karate expert, that doesn't really do the Texas Rangers justice.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris said, Cindy, Mike McNulty was telling us about, as they began to do the investigation after the first video had come out, they found that there were a couple of the Texas Rangers, captains of the Texas Rangers, who felt that the truth had not come out about Waco. And, of course, as Mike was saying, in real life, these Texas Rangers are far more dramatic than Chuck Norris was, of course, who did the story about the Texas Rangers. But you pick up the story there. Cindy, what did these Texas Rangers tell you about the seeing them? My understanding is that there were people both in the Texas Rangers and the FBI who said that this was a site of murder and it needed to be investigated as a site of murder. And we're talking about the deaths of those Davidians. So pick the story up.
Well, indeed, the location and the incident was deemed an open homicide investigation. The question lacking was, who committed the murders? The fact is that the Rangers were very frustrated in their investigations. They were not allowed to take control of the crime scene as they had wished to and were directed to. Excuse me. by the governor of the state of Texas, Ann Richards. So they had to work with the FBI.
And of course, the FBI would be covering for the FBI. So certainly murder is not a federal crime. And this was something that should have been investigated
locally.
That's
why the Rangers were there. That's why the Rangers were there, is exactly that. It wasn't a federal crime. The death of the agents was a federal crime, but the death of the Branch Davidians was a state crime.
And, of course, they were all shot in the back of the head. I mean, did they have serial?
Not all of them, Dr. Stan, but many of them.
Many of them were okay. How many were not shot in the back of the head?
The larger number of the 27 that were shot or died of gunshot wounds.
All right.
But the issue is not where were they shot and how were they shot. The issue is much broader than that. For example, the majority of the children, if not all of them, died from exposure to a high velocity or a high speed detonation of an explosive charge that was designed as a shape charge, a demolition charge, if you will, a breaching charge. It was placed on the roof of the bunker of the church vault, as it's properly known.
Are we suggesting then that the Davidians killed the children?
Well, interestingly enough, the FBI and the ATF both acknowledged the Branch Davidians didn't have the kind of explosives that it had possession of it, did not have possession of the kinds of explosives required to create the shape charge that detonated on the roof of the bunker.
So you would need very sophisticated military explosives then to do something like that.
It was the kind of thing that is right in the thick of what the Delta Force operators do and use in terms of their kit bag, their bag of tricks, if you will.
But, of course, everything has been done to suppress from the American people and conceal from the American people that the Delta Force was there.
Well, actually, it came out to some degree during the congressional hearings, very limited. What you heard mostly about was the fact that the Army would not allow the Delta Force operators to testify. They were not allowed to speak to the investigators in the congressional investigation. And then subsequently, things were handled in not a dissimilar way during the course of the civil trial where the Branch Davidians sued the federal government for the wrongful deaths of their colleagues and friends and family members. But it was discovered that there were 14 operators. For every operator, there has to be at least two support people. And so we're talking about a very large contingent from Delta Force that was certified, if you will, through the civil court proceedings. Later, we discovered not only did the Texas Rangers have some knowledge of this, but we also found that there were people available that we found. For example, the young man from who was a Delta Force member, Stephen Berry. He was a sniper trainer, and he took footage that we acquired from the Texas Rangers showing the Delta Force operators immediately in the aftermath of the fire burn down, conferencing and, shall we say, kibitzing and having a jolly old time. Over the remains of the Branch Davidians, talking and joking around and so on and so forth. And we asked that that Delta Force fellow to take these pieces of footage to the other Delta Force operators that he was in touch with and show it to them and ask them to confirm that the players that were being seen there were, in fact, Delta Force operators. And, indeed, he did so, and he testifies to that in the film. Then we also had occasion to find a gentleman by the name of Gene. Let's call him Gene for now. He was a former CIA operative who had contact with the same Delta Force operators that were operative at Waco in another place overseas in October of 1993. In that place, Mogadishu, Somalia, they had a little bit of a problem. Interestingly enough, it was President Clinton who denied them the use of armor when they were in the process of trying to capture the warlord, Faris Adid. And for the lack of that armor, a situation developed where a number of these operators were killed and Rangers were killed in an incident known as Black Hawk Down. A another one of the strange coincidences of the Clinton administration.
In other words, this was, you're suggesting that many of these people in the special forces have been involved with the murder of the children and the women and the Davidians themselves ended up getting killed over there in Somalia?
Gee, one, if one were to be just a little bit skeptical, one might think about the elimination of witnesses, things of that nature.
And, of course, anybody who's ever studied Black Hawk Down will realize, of course, that they, that thing, as far as I'm concerned, was totally staged. But that's a, that's going to be another story
well,
for another day.
The boys that participated in that were had by the civilian authorities over the military by not letting them have and use armor in that situation. They were put out in the middle of what was going to be a bloodbath, which it was. I think there was, what, 18 or 19 of those young men that were killed in that incident.
Now, were those the special forces or were those Rangers? Do we know?
It was a mix. There were Delta Force operators and Rangers that were killed.
Right. Anybody who's ever seen the movie on that will remember, of course, that they this little boy with a cell phone standing outside the enclave where the American forces were and calling ahead. And then, of course, the people, you know, rushing there, of course, with their grenades, these vehicles. You could fire the grenades to take down the helicopters. It was all planned ahead of time. We helped, apparently, you know, they knew exactly what was going to come down the line.
Well, actually, the whole operation against the American forces in that occasion was orchestrated and admitted by Al-Qaeda members.
Right.
And those individuals were captured, and I believe they're being detained in a little place called Gitmo.
Right.
You know, when it comes to that, I'm afraid you and I might be on opposite sides on the idea of the war on terror. That's not to say that I agree with George Bush's execution of the war on terror, but I do believe there are a group of Islamic jihadists who are interested in seeing the demise of our culture and our nation. And I think they proved that adequately in the 9/11 incident. So like I said, we may be on opposite sides on some of this. But
all right, that's fine. Well, let's get back to what we agree on, and that is what actually happened there. You know, at Waco that day, and Chris, there were many people, some of the people in the FBI, you even had one of them on camera saying, you know, this was a homicide and certainly an open homicide investigation. And the homicide was for the murder of the Davidians. Who was responsible for their murder?
Well, when we followed it up line, you have to understand who the players are. And from the FBI, the chain of command there has been made pretty well known. You've talked about Lon Horiuchi, and then, of course, there's the on-scene commander and the tactical commander by the name of Rogers, Dick Rogers. And then above him was a deputy attorney or deputy director of the FBI, Floyd Clark, and his ear had a certain gentleman had a lock lip on his ear, feeding him information that quote the Justice Department wanted done, but in fact his he was getting his directions directly from the White House, and that was Webster Hubbell. And Webster Hubbell was deputy attorney general under Reno. Reno was dispatched earlier in the morning of April the 19th to go and address a group of judges in Virginia that she had been scheduled for, and she was not around when all of the hot and heavy activity took place. However, Webster Hubbell was, and he was the one that was essentially giving direction to Floyd Clark. And the way we see it is the people in the White House that were directing Webster Hubbell essentially told Webb in the traditional Little Rock, Arkansas political context of just take care of it, Webb. Make it go away. It's becoming an embarrassment to the fledgling Clinton administration. It was beginning to cost too much, and it was embarrassing having these bunch of religious yahoos holding off the entire FBI hostage rescue team. And so when Webster whispered those words into the ears of Floyd Clark, something changed. The meaning and context of just take care of it when you're talking to a group of men who are heavily armed and have these people surrounded with a lot of heavy weapons takes on an entirely different meaning than a political context, just take care of it. Now, the persons in the White House, so we found from the Texas Rangers, the captains of Texas Rangers, the people that were talking to Webster was none other than Vincent Foster. And Mr. Foster was interacting with his old colleague from the Rose Law Firm, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
And, of course, some people think that the Webster Hubble felt very bad about all those little children being slaughtered and blown up, and the women. And
actually, Mr. Foster felt bad about that, yes.
And, of course, very soon after that, he himself was dead.
July the 20th, 1993, Mr. Foster was found dead in Fort Marcy Park.
All right, fine. And so, certainly, it's a strange thing that Vincent Foster was killed. And, of course, we've talked to a number of people who were involved with that investigation. And those people who questioned what the government said came under tremendous pressure. And they were harassed, and they were followed, and their homes were broken into, and they were all the techniques were done to intimidate them. A massive campaign of intimidation on people who were just going to testify about what they knew. Why was the Clinton administration so concerned that the truth might come out about the strange death of Vincent Foster? And what did Vincent Foster know? And then, of course, he had a lot of course, information in his safe. And what happened to all that information that Vince Foster had that might have been embarrassing to the Clinton administration?
Well, that's an interesting story. It seemed that to set the frame for this, you have to understand that during the course of the Whitewater investigation conducted by the United States Senate and led by Special Counsel Michael Chertoff, who is currently the head of Homeland Security now, Mr. Chertoff really did dig into it, and it started getting a little embarrassing. And what he found is that according to Foster's staff, a number of his staff members indicated that he had been working for some time since April of 93, on a document that some refer to as a letter of resignation, others refer to as an expose, about what was the White House's involvement in the Waco incident of April the 19th, the day the place burned down. Interestingly enough, the document that was referred to was worked on by Mr. Foster the very morning of his death. That document, along with a number of other documents, as it turns out, was removed rather surreptitiously at the midnight hour by Maggie Williams, the chief of staff of Hillary Rodham Clinton, and Bernie Nussbaum, the presidential counsel, who had received an order earlier that day to secure, lock up, and allow no one into Mr. Foster's office so that the FBI could conduct an investigation into his death. However, at midnight, or the midnight hour of that evening of Mr. Foster's death, Mr. Nussbaum and Miss Williams were seen exiting Mr. Foster's office.
But wasn't there guard?
Armloads of files.
But wasn't there guard on the office?
No, the person they were seen by was the Secret Service agent in charge of securing the area.
Right.
Mr. O'Neill.
Right.
Harry O'Neill. And so he testified to that. When the FBI went in to the office to look for all of the documents, including that particular one about Waco, it's obvious that Mr. Chertoff was aware of it, and the FBI did not find said document. However, when he questioned Mr. Foster's staff, what he found is that and other documents had been purloined by Ms. Williams, had been put together in a box and were carried by Mr. Kennedy, the intern for Mr. Foster, in the company of Ms. Williams, and it was carried some days later. Those documents were carried some days later and hand-delivered to the First Lady in the private residential quarters of the White House upstairs, and she received those documents. So the last person to have those documents in their possession was Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Kurtenbach was just saying that the documents, of course, that Mr. Vince Foster was working on at the time of his unfortunate suicide, when, of course, he supposedly killed himself, but there was a lot of questions, very serious questions, that this had been a murder, and certainly I've talked to people who they were at Fort Marcy Park, and, the cars were moved around, and, of course, Vince Foster's car wasn't there until after he had committed suicide, and there was questions about the gun, where the gun had come from, because, you know, it's illegal to have a gun in Washington, D.C., but I guess maybe when you're the special counsel of the president, it's all right to have an unregistered gun under any circumstances. The documents, of course, that we're looking for disappeared after Hillary Clinton saw them. And, of course, these are documents that could have been possibly brought out the truth about what really happened at Waco. So pick up the story there, Mike.
Well, these documents went into the personal possession of Hillary Rodham Clinton, according to the testimony of the witnesses involved. However, I found it really interesting that Mr. Chertoff did not pursue Mrs. Clinton and her possession of these documents, nor did he seek the documents from her. And we've learned recently in some rather interesting documents released by one of the prosecutors, he passed away recently, and his personal files contained a lot of information about why the special counsel, Mr. Chertoff, did not go after Mrs. Clinton. They knew she had been lying. She was lying about it on a number of points. And they didn't go after her because they felt that because of who she was, the probability of getting a successful prosecution, a conviction, wouldn't be very likely. So they didn't want to embarrass themselves. So
it seems strange that Mr. Chertoff, in a Democratic administration, would be the man that President Bush would pick to head the Office of Homeland Security. Why would he pick a man who'd worked for the Democrats, or had he suddenly become a Republican?
No, I believe Chertoff is a Republican, he's a go-to guy.
Right.
He's the kind of guy, for example, when the Clintons were frustrated in hiding Waco, and we brought out this very film, Waco, A New Revelation, it embarrassed Janet Reno to the degree that, and the Clintons, that they felt that they needed to absolve themselves. So they went to their go-to guy, a Republican, a ranking and now retired Republican senator by the name of Jack Danforth, who went and did a marvelous job of covering up the whole incident instead of bringing out the truth. And that particular bit of business is another story for another time. But in the meantime, we have this situation where the documents were in Mrs. Clinton's possession, and Mr. Chertoff knew it, but simply did not proceed against Mrs. Clinton. Well, now Mrs. Clinton is running for president of the United States, or at least she was up until recently. And now the possibility exists that she may become Barack Obama's running mate. Well, if that becomes the case, we're going to have to take a very close look at re-releasing, in a formal way, the Waco A New Revelation, so that people can see the 20 or 25-minute segment about Vince Foster and the documents and Mrs. Clinton, and understand the depth and breadth of the horribleness of what actually happened at Waco in those 51 days.
Well, of course, if Hussein Obama wants to win, he will pick Hillary Clinton as his running mate. But if he wants to have a long and successful life, he certainly will not. She's already made references.
I think that could be said. But likewise, some would say a good insurance policy for Obama as President of the United States, to protect him from the vagaries of those who might commit assassination, would be to have Hillary back there in the vice presidential chair, and so that people would know that if he leaves the scene for any reason, that's what they're going to get.
All right, fine. Well, all we can do is speculate at this time. But, of course, we do know, of course, when Gerald Ford was the president, there were several unsuccessful attempts on his life because Nelson Rockefeller wanted to be the president. We know that, of course, there was an unsuccessful attempt on President Reagan's life because, in fact, the man who tried to kill President Reagan was the son of a very close friend of the vice president at that time, George Bush. We do know what happened after President Kennedy was assassinated and just Lyndon Johnson became president. Do really people kill to get to be in the presidency? Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Mike McNulty, but we're really talking about Waco. What really happened that day? And certainly I had an opportunity of talking to Sarah Bain, who was the head of the jury that actually heard the case. And she told me in no uncertain terms, the wrong people were on trial. The wrong people were on trial, which is meaning that the Davidians should have been let off scot-free and get people from government should have been sent to prison. But as with Janet Reno there, why we know how things turned out. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Mike McNulty. Mike, pick up the story there.
Well, Dr. Stan, after discovering all this, I mean, we did evolve our whole storytelling business to a final version, and that is Waco, A New Revelation. Pretty much everything that we could tell is in there, with the exception of a few additional points. We produced a third short film called The FLIR Project, which addressed the issues of chief concern about the activities of Senator Jack Danforth and his cover-up. Focusing exclusively on the gunfight issues were the flashes seen on the FBI's videotape from the air that day of the fire. Really gunfire, or were they, as Mr. Danforth contends, solar reflections? I think we conclusively show in the short film Waco, or that is the FLIR project, we conclusively show that indeed they are gunfire flashes. And we show how and why, and a great deal of scientific effort went into that film. The upshot of it all is that Danforth simply did his best to bury the whole business and, you know, plant a flag in it, bury it, plant a flag in it, and declare victory and walk home. Essentially, that didn't fly too well. And there's a lot of folks who still think that the questions that we've raised about Waco are unanswered and unchallenged. And I would certainly support that point of view. Why is it important today? Because justice has not been served, first and foremost. The victims of all of the activities of April the 19th, a number of them have finally been released from prison. All the Davidians that were sent to prison have finally been released some 15 years later. The termination of this whole business is justice for those who perpetrated the deeds portrayed in the films. And nothing has come of that, nothing at all. You've mentioned Lon Horiuchi being in a protective custody or witness protection program. That's the least that could happen to Mr. Horiuchi. Very unpleasant circumstances, but you have to remember, while he was the sniper who shot and killed Vicki Weaver at Ruby Ridge, he was also, weeks later, a sniper leader, a sniper team leader at Waco, and he was the one that called the code that said that...
Hold that thought, hold me back for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were talking about Lon Horiuchi. Lon Horiuchi was the FBI sniper who blew off the head of Vicki Weaver when she was holding her child. And, of course, he was acting under orders. He was just doing what he was told to do. They decided they were going to kill Vicki Weaver because she was the leader there. And if they killed her, then the rest of the family would give up. And so he blew off her head, an innocent woman standing, you know, with a child in her hand. And then he was the sniper leader at Waco a few weeks later. What was was his job there as a sniper leader, and what part did he play in what happened at Waco?
Well, he was located at the sniper position known as Sierra One, which was the farmhouse directly across the street from Mount Carmel. And his job on April the 19th was to observe and keep an eye on the tanks, and if he saw any indications of gunfire, that he and or any of the other FBI agents who were in that position as observers were to report it as compromise. And that was the code word. And he was the one that called the word compromise early in the morning when the first tanks put the started putting CS gas into the building. He also doesn't appear to have any other role that day at Waco, none that we were aware of or could find evidence of. However, there was a question of some expended 308 caliber cartridges, cartridge cases that were found, and Danforth did an investigation that said, oh, no, those cases were left over from when the ATF was at that location. They had fired the cartridges. Well, that's awfully convenient, but knowing the FBI is very, very careful about crime scene maintenance. And when the FBI took over that location, I dare say, and so did Dr. Fred Whitehurst, that they went through that building with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that any evidence relative to the activities of the ATF were removed. So how is it that the Texas Rangers found these expended cartridge cases at Sierra One, the location where Lon Horiuchi was lodged, on the day after April the 19th when they started inspecting the building? You know, the FBI people indicated in their reports that they were being fired on from the building that day, and that is the Mount Carmel building, and that the rounds struck the ranch house across the road. And the document that Janet Reno signed off on gave the FBI explicit permission to return fire if they were fired on. Not just add more gas, but return fire. And in fact, our contention is that the FBI did just that. So finding expended shell casings under the aegis of a crime scene that already had been cleaned once after the fact of the second incident, that is the fire, the day of the fire, April 19th, doesn't seem to jive, doesn't seem to wash very well. And what's fascinating to me is that the procedure for the weapons handling of the firearms involved and used by the FBI were grossly neglected and did not come up to any kind of law enforcement, much less scientific specs, relative to, okay, for example, the bolt head of the firearm, bolt-action rifle. Apparently, these were changed out on a regular basis, so as under the aegis of to keep the accuracy quotient functional to where operating parts in firearms, whether they're M16s or a bolt-action rifle, would be changed out to new ones and fitted by the armors. Well, that occurred after April the 19th, but prior to long before Mr. Danforth came along and inspected the weapons, so-called. The original firearms, in terms of their innards, that might leave tool marks on shell casings, etc., had been changed out long before that. So it's like, okay, nobody's looking, nobody knows what the procedures are. We'll just take a look at what they got now and call it good to go. Well, I'm sorry, guys, that doesn't work. Well, know what the procedures were.
Well, of course, one of the big things is, of course, they insisted that they never used any sort of explosive grenades or anything like that in the building or anything that was pyrotechnic. And yet, of course, when you and Chris got into the evidence room, and you did that with the help of the prosecutor, the federal prosecutor who sent those innocent people to prison, the Davidians, and he eventually had second thoughts about it. He realized he was risking everything, but he helped you. He was an honest man. Well, she paid for it by, you know, being, they came after him. They destroyed his career. They took away a lot. Did he ever go to jail? They knew they were going to try to send him.
No, he managed to avoid that, but he lost his law license. He was fired from his job as a prosecutor. Attorney. And he had a sort of, with the support of those in the Waco community who knew him, who knew what kind of a guy he was, they knew he was being used as a scapegoat. He has recovered to some degree. His law practice is now active. His law license has been restored. And while he's not exactly known as a good friend of the federal government, he's well thought of in the Waco community.
Well, I think that's more important than being well thought of by Janet Reno. But under any circumstances, you were actually able to get into the evidence room, and with his help, and of course the government was furious when you got in.
Actually.
But what did you find there that showed that they were lying? If the government would lie about that, what else would they lie about?
Well, what we found was, first thing, we walked through the door and the lights were not on yet, and I stumbled over something that was left on the floor in the entryway to the evidence locker. And it was a cut-down cardboard case for Corona beer. And in it were stuffed dozens of videotapes. And these were the originals. These were the videotapes made by the Texas Rangers during their aftermath investigation, during the course of events. And indeed, we found copies of the original FLIR tapes. And what was interesting about that was the FBI said there was only one. Well, actually, there were three. One in the early morning, the one central in the afternoon, and one in the late afternoon. And so we started with those, and we started with photographs that we had recovered from the attorneys in the criminal case much earlier on. And some of those were in file, and documents were in file in the evidence locker. Certainly not all. Everything wasn't there, but we started noticing things when we started pulling out evidence bags holding objects that had been mislabeled. For example, there were, I believe there were, if I remember right, there were six M25 flashbang devices made by DevTech. And these devices had been burned. They were made out of a heavy armor plate steel, and so that they would be able to hold up during the course of use when an explosive charge, the equivalent of a quarter stick of dynamite, would be detonated inside of these devices. It would direct the explosive force outwards in such a way as it would not cause the object to become a projectile, but it would it's sufficient to where it can kill and maim if you're close to that thing when it goes off. So these had sort of a fuse head assembly like a regular hand grenade on the top, and most of the ones that we found still had the fuse head intact on top, which meant they had not been used during the course of the the only people that had them were the BATF at that point on February 28th. And they were used during the course of the February 28th raid that they had conducted. But there were several of them that still had the fuse heads on them, some that didn't. And what was interesting was those, all of them had cooked off, of course, during the course of the fire. But they were all labeled, the majority of them were labeled as silencers for handguns instead of flashbang devices. They were mislabeled. And, gee, who do you suppose were the people that were in charge of finding the evidence and labeling it and packaging it? Who would you think? Texas Rangers? Not hardly. It was the FBI. And they had mismarked these devices. Well, the curious thing was is the matrix that the Texas Rangers had developed showing where evidence was found in the remains or the rubble of Mount Carmel, these devices had been found at several of the locations of the points of origin of the fires, according to their own fire investigation. So having a pyrotechnic device of that nature that are referred to in law enforcement as fire starters one has to wonder why these things were mislabeled and never appeared in the arson investigation as being present at those locations.
Well, because the government insisted that the Davidians had committed suicide. They started all the fires. And
of course.
And of
now,
course,
here's my theory on the fires, plural. There were at least four points of origin, and the government says three. I believe the first point of origin was at the bedroom, second-story bedroom on the southwest corner, or southeast corner, I'm sorry, the one that everyone remembers seeing the flames coming out of the window and so on and so forth. I believe that was an accidental fire, and it was initiated when the tank inserted CS gas at the southwest corner. It put in a full complement, a full bottle, into that location. And one of the things we discovered during the FLIR project exercises was that methylene chloride, the compound that was used as the chemical carrier for the CS dust in what the government had used, left flammable vapors. And we tried to see if they could be ignited. And indeed they could be, very easily, in the open, much less a confined room space, by the muzzle flash of an M16.
Well, I thought that the CS gas had actually been outlawed for use in warfare against enemies, but it's all right to use them against Americans, women, and children.
Well, the CS gas, that's a misnomer, Stanley. The reason that CS gas was outlawed from use by the federal authorities or by the Army was because it mimicked some characteristics of nerve gas.
Right.
And what they were concerned with, according to the treaty documents, the reason it was banned was because it did mimic, and what they were concerned with, nerve gas elements, in some of the symptoms that were generated. And what they were concerned with was that an inappropriate escalation could occur on the battlefield if the opposing forces felt they had been that nerve gas had been used, and in actuality it was CS. In other words, it wasn't bad enough. It was inappropriate for use by the military for that reason. But that's not to say that the methodology, in other words, the way it was used and applied on the Branch Davidians was grossly inappropriate. From the standpoint of our experts told us that a number of the Branch Davidians suffocated, particularly the women and the children, some of the women and the children.
Those who weren't killed by the explosives, that is.
In the church storage vault before the explosion.
I see.
And in fact, the methylene chloride, what we found is the carrier agent, it will ignite when a muzzle flash comes in contact with the sprayed vapors. And what we found in the FBI 302 reports was a report of a Branch Davidian dressed in black fired a weapon at the tank as it pulled away from the building that day at that location. And our belief is that first fire started when a flash fire was ignited by the muzzle flash of the weapon igniting the vapors from the methylene chloride that had been put in the building at that location by the tank for the last infusion of CS into the building. So we call that first one an accidental fire. The next three locations, the first being the dining room area, we believe that was initiated by some pyrotechnic devices fired from the back of an ACV Bradley fighting vehicle at the back of the compound away from the TV cameras. And we found evidence, first photographs, and then we found some pyrotechnic devices that had been fired into the building and passed through the walls and had detonated. And we found some of those 40-millimeter grenades, and we found photographs of the military pyrotechnic CS gas devices that had been fired at the building. And what happened was our friend Danforth and before that Janet Reno focused on the two devices that we discovered, and that's all they talked about. They didn't talk about the DevTech 25s. They didn't talk about the penetrating stun munitions. They didn't talk about the 200 rounds of high explosive fragmentation 40-millimeter grenades that was provided by Fort Hood in Texas. The commander of the base provided those munitions to the FBI, and the FBI was not required to return unused portions or to give any report or indication on what was used. We believe some of those were used, the fragmentation rounds. And we also found a number of rounds had been fired into the back of the gymnasium. That was location four. Number three is interesting because, in fact, the Branch Davidians had attempted to build what they referred to as fire traps, bales of hay soaked in Coleman fuel, etc., to try and toss in on top of the tanks if they came into the building, which indeed they did. And both that the tanks came into the building and that the Branch Davidians, at least at one occasion, at one location, attempted to initiate a fire themselves as individuals, and that would have been the chapel area fire that is listed as the third location. So we have a mix of accidental startings, startings on the part by the acts of the government, and fire starting by the act of the Branch Davidians. So to simply say, well, the Branch Davidians did it all is certainly a gross misstatement, a lie. And to say that the government was totally responsible would equally be a lie. So we have to be careful to follow the evidence where it takes us, and that's where it's taken us on the fire starting issue.
All right, fine. And, of course, you bring all of this out. And, of course, all of this was totally suppressed by the government. They repeatedly denied they used anything that might be started the fire, didn't they?
I mean, as far as they were concerned, the Branch Davidians started the fires at the three or four locations, and that's all there was to it.
And, of course, did they ever talk about what killed the little children there, and 17 little children?
Oh, what they say, what Jack Danforth ultimately said was, the first report, the initial report, said the Branch Davidians had black powder hand grenades that went off on the roof of the bunker and caused the 20-inch hole to be blown through the 9-inch thick steel-reinforced concrete roof of the bunker.
Well,
nope, didn't happen.
Senator Dancer is one of the finest senators that money can buy. Well, Mike, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Well, sir, I think because of the connections to Mrs. Clinton and the unanswered questions about her involvement, I think in the interest of justice for all the lives that were lost, and I include in that the four federal agents that died and the agents that were wounded and the Branch Davidians that died on that incident on February 28th and those that died on April the 19th, justice demands an answer. And we have not had answers. We've had excellent cover-ups, very expensive cover-ups. We've had a lot of dodging and weaving. We've had a lot of lying and storytelling that's false, defaming, if nothing else, of the Branch Davidians themselves. Were they perfect? Were they the kind of folks that you would bring home to dinner on Sunday evening? Probably not. But then again, in meeting them in the aftermath, I don't find their character to be capable of the things that the federal government has accused them of. And I think that the federal government basically justified many of the things that occurred there against the Branch Davidians in terms of the federal government's actions. And the question is, as the protest sign said in Waco during that time period, is your church ATF approved? And I think that's sort of the bottom line because, you know, folks, the one thing that doesn't change in government is the bureaucrats who run things. The folks that gave you Waco, the folks that gave you Oklahoma City, the folks that gave you 9/11 and everything else that followed, they're still there. And the question is, what can we do about it?
Some of the people, and I've heard this, you probably would know it better than I, that some of those people who went in the upper room, there were four people that died that morning for the attack, that some of those had been Bill Clinton's bodyguards in the past. Is there any truth to that?
Say that again?
That some of the people who were killed on the first day of the onslaught there at Waco had actually been part of a secret service and had worked for Bill Clinton in the past, that they had actually were not necessarily BATF.
You're talking about the BATF agents?
Right.
The truth of that situation is that there were three or four BATF agents, several of which were killed that day.
Right.
And the coincidence is this. When Bill Clinton was a candidate, there were so many president and vice presidential candidates running around that the Secret Service ran short of security people. And some of the ATF agents that were at Waco that day had indeed performed as bodyguards for Bill Clinton during the course of the 92 election.
Well, that's all. We're out of time. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's been Mike McNulty. And anyway, if anybody would like to get the entire tape or CD, we have that available. Mike, thanks very much. We'll look forward to talking to you again, I guess, on Thursday evening.
Yep, we'll be there.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Well, Mike McNulty is a very, very courageous guy. He gave many years of his life trying to get the story out. I think he's honest. He's impartial. And we carry the video, Waco, A New Revelation. We carry the DVD, we have Waco Rules of Engagement in video, and we have Waco A New Revelation in DVD, and we just got a supply of those in. And then, of course, we have 2 4 tape sets on Waco, and we hope that you'll want to get this information and go over it, because if we don't understand the past, we certainly can't understand what's going on today. And I personally, of course, talked to the mother of the gentleman, of Clive, I've forgotten his last name, but Clive's mother, and she told me that on the day that the day afterwards, she was in a trailer with a friend of hers. Somebody called and said, look, I saw what really happened. I was looking at the back of the compound, what nobody else could see. And I will never tell anybody else what happened that day, but I'll tell you. And they got the Davidians out there, and they lined them up, and they shot them all in the back of the head, and then they dragged them in. Now, is that true? I don't know. This is what she told me personally. I sent this to Bob Barr during the Waco investigation, congressional Waco investigation. Bob Barr saw fit never to use that information. Maybe he never got it. But, of course, I'll never forget, you know, could this really have happened? Are there really people in America who would think nothing of killing helpless people? And I would like to suggest there really are. They're professional killers. They're trained by our government to do this sort of thing. And they probably, well, they're doing it under orders. Lon Horiocchi was just carrying out orders. I talked to Kay Grigg this morning. Her husband was a professional assassin for the government. And he was just carrying out orders, you know, Colonel Marvin. Before he became a Christian, he was trained as an assassin, and he was just going to be carrying out orders. They all justify this, just as the SS did in Hitler's Germany, and understand that there are very similar spirits of forces that are energizing the people in America today, similar to those that energized what happened in Adolf Hitler's time. And those 17 little children died. And they died, and of course, many of the Davidians were shot, and many of them were shot in the back of the head. And if you get our 4 tape sets, you'll realize we've never, of course, got the full truth about what really happened that day. And so give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. The first video, Waco, The Rules of Engagement. Waco, A New Revelation. We have the FLIR tape. All of these are available. 2 of them are on video, 1's on DVD. And then we have 2 4 tape sets. Listen to this. Understand history. And then you can talk a lot better about what's going on today. And then we've got a great new DVD. It's called Architects and Engineers. It's called, Blueprint for Terror. And it's put out by Architects and Engineers for 911 Truth. That's Blueprint for Terror. And, of course, it goes into the background of what happened on September 11th, because we haven't been told the truth about that either. And, of course, you need to get my little pamphlets on Foreknowledge 911 and about the passports. And could you imagine a passport, you know, escaping from the flaming wreckage of the plane that crashed into the North Tower, and then from the flaming wreckage of the tower there itself, and floating down to be found on the street a block and a half from the North Tower in pristine condition? Another one, of course, if you've ever seen the crash site at there in Pennsylvania. Why, of course, there's no wreckage. I mean, the plane just disintegrated. All the bodies, everything on that plane, everything disintegrated. There was only one thing that they found, or one or two things they found. One of them was a passport of one of the terrorists. It was slightly tinged, burned, actually up on the FBI website for some time. How did those passports, well, of course, they knew that the terrorists were on board because there were their passports, and they rolled the windows down before the planes crashed. The only explanation. Ladies and gentlemen, they've been lying to us, and it's about time we understood that there really are evil people. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to read it. You need, of course, to get our talk on the forbidden secret. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, and then pray for America, pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.